using the antenna tuner. In either case, you can change the load factor.
VB2HWW with a comment.
So let me turn it back to Ed on that one. Ed, does that make some sense to you? We'll pick up Howie in a minute. K2TJE, K2RIW, go ahead, Ed.
Yes, it makes some sense, but without exceeding the rating of the tube or glowing it red, just one other factor. I have an old transmitter here that was built in the 50s. I pay more attention to the screen. When I get the least amount of screen current on my metering, I'm getting the most amount of power out, over.
That's a very smart observation, Ed. Most Tetra 2s, particularly the 4CX250B that I'm most familiar with, and I think it's also true of 6146s, at resonance, the screen current is an extremely strong indication of whether or not the plate circuit is properly loaded. When you turn it out of resonance, you'll see the screen current either go negative or positive, or when you change the loading, you'll see the screen current go positive or negative. Screen current near zero on most Tetra tubes gives maximum power output. Would you like to know why that happens, Ed? Go ahead.
I'm making a guess that it's because more of the electrons are going to the plate rather than the screen. Over.
Okay. When you're seeing a positive screen current versus zero screen current, you're absolutely right. When you see negative screen current, what do you think's happening in that case, Ed?
I think that you got some big problems. Over.
Not at all. Not at all. It's good, solid physics. Let me show you what's really happening. At the instant the control grid has a positive signal voltage, because that's the positive portion of the sine wave, that's your drive signal, a great big chunk of electrons leave that cathode. A chunk of electrons get accelerated by the screen grid. The majority of the current and the life of the tool, how lively your tool is a function of screen current, to the 3/8 power. You raise the screen voltage, the DC voltage you put on the screen grid, or you can start getting a hell of a lot more gain and a hell of a lot more peak current out of that tube. What happens to, you're accelerating more of those electrons coming from that cathode when the screen voltage is positive. So let's assume that I've got, let me pick a number, 300 volts on the screen, 800 volts on the plate. Maybe those are closer to the real voltages. Let's see, screen voltage 300, that's the number for 4CX250B. I'm not sure if that's the number for 6146, but your plate voltage, you know, is swinging with the RF voltage. At the instant the cloud of electrons come roaring through that screen grid, they now are in the middle of the screen grid area, and they're looking forward to that plate. If the plate is more positive at that instant of time, those electrons go through the screen grid area, go toward the plate, and give you some nice plate current. Let me drop. However, if the plate circuit is in resonance and lightly loaded, the voltage on the plate will now have a great big swing. And the voltage on the plate might, on the negative half cycle, swing down to near 0 volts. So here you've got this cloud of electrons starting to go through the screen grid. They're sitting at the screen grid area near 300 volts. They're looking at that plate. The plate is near 0 volts, 300 volts lower than the screen grid. Therefore, the electrons say, I ain't going to go there. They're going to go to the screen grid. So with light loading, the screen current starts climbing real high. All those electrons coming from that cathode, accelerated by the control grid, see this positive 300 volts on the screen, and they stick to the screen and give you a great big positive current, the normal way we measure current on the screen grid. Let me drop. Now, when the plate is very heavily loaded, by definition, the voltage swing on the plate is going to be a much smaller number. Maybe the voltage on the plate is now going to start off at 800 volts, swing down to 600, and swing up to 1,000. It's only got a 400 volt peak to peak in my case. At that negative peak, when the plate is down to 600, and the screen is at 300, the electrons that are in the middle of the screen at that time say, I'm not going to go to the screen. That plate is much more positive. They're all going to go to the plate. If you make the plate loading heavy enough, so that the plate voltage is now always much higher than the screen grid voltage, those electrons that were going to hit the screen, a certain number of them do hit the screen, they create secondary emission. In other words, the screen grid starts acting a little bit as a cathode. Some of those electrons get bounced off of the screen, go toward the plate. So now the total amount of current going to the plate can be greater than the current of the electrons that left the cathode. That's where the negative screen grid current is coming from. It's secondary emission because the plate is so positive. Let me drop. So now you can see throughout the whole swing of the voltage on the plate, when you've now got maximum power output of the tube, where the voltage can swing as much as possible without going to negative numbers on the low end and going to super high voltages on the high end, you get the best balance of the electrons coming through the screen, deciding whether or not they're going to go to the plate or whether they're going to go to the screen. If the majority of the electrons in the screen area see the plate as a more positive voltage and go there, but not so darn high in positive voltage that you start creating secondary emission, that's the condition where the screen current is very close to zero. So in most cases, a tetra tube in resonance loaded so that the screen current is very near zero, sometimes a little bit positive, sometimes a little negative. That's where you get maximum power output. Does that make a little bit of sense to Ed? K2GJE, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it does. I must have done something right when I built this years ago. By the way, it's a 4-125A running with 1,500 volts on the plate and about 600 volts on the screen. I've never seen negative screen current. When it's running at its best, looking at the power output meter, is about 20 milliamps on the screen. And maybe 200 milliamps on the plate. And it's an old transmitter, and I haven't had it on the air in years, but it used to put out one whopper of a signal that anyone I heard I was able to talk to. By the way, thanks for all the TV information. I hope I don't, in 2020, have to put my set out at the curb. Over.
Yeah, I'm a little bit afraid, Ed, that many of us will be putting the set out to the curb, so to speak, or using it as some kind of a monitor, because it looks to me like they're fixing to make sure that we're all going to buy new sets. That's what I think is going to happen. Now, we got VDH and Howie in that order listed here. Mr. VDH, please tell me your name and a comment you wanted to make. Go right ahead. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Comment on this current subject.
VDH is ahead of you. Mr. VDH, start off and with your name, sir, and your comment.
Okay, fine, this is Dick. First of all, my name is John, the handle is John, and the call is WA2VDH. It's just that comment about the antenna tuner re-reflecting the power. It can show that pretty much the only thing that will totally re-reflect power is an open circuit, a short, or a pure reactant. So the antenna tuner cannot totally re-reflect the reflected power. I can give an example if you want. Go ahead.
Go right ahead, John.
Okay, if you have a generator, a 20-volt generator, AC generator, whose internal resistance is 50 ohms. Okay, I think I did this once before. Take a half wave of line terminated with 50 plus J150. Go a half wave and now put a minus J150 capacitor. That's your antenna tuner. You've gone a half wave, so the capacitor now cancels out the plus J150, leaving you 50 ohms. You put this generator of 20 volts in series with 50 ohms on the other side of that capacitor, it sees a 1-to-1 SWR. On the load side of that capacitor, you still have an extremely high SWR, yet the full available power of that generator, which is 2 watts, 20 volts, 50 ohms, if you put a 50 ohm load on it, you get 10 volts across it. 10 squared over 50 is 2 watts. The full 2 watts of power gets to that 50 plus J150 load. So on the generator side of that capacitor as the antenna tuner, you have a 1-to-1 SWR. Looking on the load side of that capacitor, you do not see, you see a load of 50 minus J150. So you can't have total re-reflection of the power. Go ahead.
Okay. When I'm using my antenna tuner, you and I think have had a couple of emails back and forth on this one, and we didn't quite settle it. Maybe tonight we'll come a little closer to settling it. Assuming now I've got a bird watt meter on the input end of an antenna tuner, and I've adjusted, and I've got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna, and I've set my antenna tuner just right, so that I know that 30% of the voltage, 10% of the power, 10% of the power is being reflected by the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio of the antenna and the transmission line. I'm seeing a 2-to-1 at the input end of the transmission line. So I know that 10% of the power is reflected back to the antenna tuner. My bird watt meter on the input end of the antenna tuner tells me nothing is reflected. The transmitter is seeing a 1-to-1. Of the power that's reflected to the antenna tuner, you say not all of it can be re-reflected forward. In that particular simple example I just gave you right now, where do you believe the reflected power is going? Over to you, John. KQIW.
Well, some of it is getting reflected. Some of it is getting reflected, but what looks like it's being totally reflected is that the antenna tuner is introducing a phase shift so that you get voltage addition, so that now the forward power is such that when that forward power reaches the load, it's able to deliver the full generator power, the full transmitter power to the load. Yes, we do have reflected power on the load side of the tuner because we have a 2-to-1 SWR. Okay, but as far as that power being totally re-reflected, it's hard to say because what's happening as far as the power addition there, because now we have voltages that are in phase. And when you're dealing with voltages that are in phase, superposition of power doesn't hold. We can't really do a superposition of power there. Go ahead.
I disagree with you on this one, John. Let me make the example a little bit more extreme. 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio is a magic number where exactly half of the power is reflected. If I've got a large enough range on my antenna tuner, I can tolerate a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio. Assume I have a zero loss transmission line, open wire line, so that of the reflected power, none of it, although it's going to be bouncing back and forth on the transmission line, none of it's radiated, none of it's absorbed, because I've got a nearly lossless transmission line. Okay, I'm running 100 watts. 100 watts is coming out of the transmitter, goes through the antenna tuner that I properly set into this 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio. Half the power is coming back, and if I now had a bird watt meter on the input end of the antenna tuner and the output end of the antenna tuner, I would see a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio on the input end. My bird watt meter would say 100 watts is going forward and nothing is coming back at the input end of the antenna tuner. On the output end of the antenna tuner, I would see 200 watts going forward, 100 watts coming back. Because of the 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio of the antenna, all power that hits the antenna, half of it's reflected, half of it's radiated. Because I'm putting 200 watts into it, 100 watts is radiated. So that's a lossless system with a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio, and there's an extra 50 watts going back and forth on that transmission line. All of that 50 watts, all of that 100 watts that was reflected from the antenna once the system is stabilized is re-reflected forward. That's why I'm saying 200 watts forward. Is the 200 watts forward real? I say absolutely. Drop. It consists of two signals being vector-headed together in phase. power the transmitter is producing right now and the power that's being reflected forward. Many people in that situation will say, hey, that's only reactive power. It's not real. The 200 watts. I say it's real. I can put a directional coupler on that, sample a small amount of it. I will see a sample indicating 200 watts. And is that power real? I can take that sample and light a light bulb with it. It's real. So that it's kind of hard to figure out what is the real output of heat in the antenna tuner to make that happen. There's two reasons why that's kind of complicated. Number one, we call the transmitter a 50-ohm source. That means when it's loaded with 50 ohms, it gives the right performance. But when you look back into the transmitter, it's a constant current generator. It's almost an open circuit. It won't absorb power. But the bird wattmeter on the input end of the antenna tuner told us that nothing was coming back from that point. So it was nothing but the antenna tuner that was re-reflecting that power forward. So in that example that I've given, I will see 200 watts on the bird wattmeter on the output end. And a bird wattmeter in that situation gives you readings that drive people up the wall that can't believe it. As long as you understand what it's telling you a truth. Maybe it's a painful truth, but it's telling you a real truth. At first, you're going to disagree with us, and I don't blame you. It's not an easy concept to accept. W-A-2-V-E-H, K-2-L-I-W, very John.
Yeah, fine business, Dick. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you about the powers. There has to be 200 watts forward on that line with a 5.8 to 1 SWR, and there's 100 watts reflected. Suppose now the generator, the transmitter source, was a generator that had an internal impedance of 50 ohms. Say it was a dual voltage generator in series with a 50 ohm resistor that under matching conditions could deliver 100 watts. Would you say that looking in on the load side of that antenna tuner, you would see a pure reactive, which is the only thing that could give you a total re-reflection of the power? Go ahead.
I think the answer is no. However, what impedance would you see at the output end of the antenna tuner looking back into that antenna tuner, which is connected to a 50-ohm transmitter? If the transmitter is turned off and still acting as a pure 50-ohm load, would I see a pure reactance? Absolutely not. I would definitely see a resistive component. In which case, you're therefore going to say, hey, the reflective power is being absorbed by the resistor. There's going to be a definite resistive component when the transmitter is turned off. However, when the transmitter is turned on, the voltage that you would have presented across the 50 ohm resistance of the transmitter is being matched by an equal voltage being made by the transmitter. If the transmitter is now producing, let me take a number, 100 volts, then the signal being reflected back through the antenna tuner is again 100 volts in phase. So the positive 100 volts coming back through the antenna tuner hitting the transmitter and the 100 volts that the transmitter is generating are in phase with each other, and therefore no current occurs. That would be exactly a condition where you're not creating any power. So there's a magic set of numbers. The fact that there's an active source makes the situation complicated. When you're looking back into the antenna tuner, when the transmitter is running, that's a difficult test to do. You'd have to be using an additional signal generator with a directional coupler on an extremely close frequency, a couple of kilohertz away, with very fine filtering on a spectrum analyzer so that you could really measure the apparent impedance looking into the output end of the antenna tuner while the transmitter is running. It'd be a difficult test to do, but you would see a resistive component. It can't be purely reactive, because in which case the transmitter wouldn't be able to put power through it, if you know what I mean. So it's a complicated case. You and I have tried on this one before and didn't come up with a nice round answer in the past on this one, John. W-2-V-E-H, K-2-L-I-W in the TechNet.
Yeah, five boosters, Vic. That's why I was saying, because it's not pure reactants, you can't have total re-reflection. As far as I can see, it has to do with the fact that because the voltages are in phase, we really can't do the superposition of power that's normally done. That's why I was trying to use that that simple case where the 50 plus J150 on a half wave of line, and then just a simple capacitor of minus J150 as the antenna tuner. It sort of makes life a little easier to calculate. But as far as I can see, because we have voltages that are in phase, voltage addition is occurring, and therefore power superposition or power addition kind of becomes a little hokey, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Vic. I won't take up too much more time on the net on this, but I really appreciate the discussion.
The nonlinear circuits, that's why you can't do superposition.
As long as you know what you're doing, you can do superposition, I'm pretty sure, Richard. You're going to be getting, we know in my example, with a 5.8 standing wave ratio and 100 watt transmitter, it's going to be 200 watts going forward. Whatever the voltage of the normal 100 watts is going to be, twice the power, that means it's going to be a 41% increase in voltage. So there's going to be the reflected power going forward gives you a 41% increase on the voltage coming out of the transmitter, the add in phase. As long as you know what you're doing, vectors in this situation have got to work, keeping all the numbers coming out reasonable. The fact that the output impedance of the antenna tuner, when you look back into it, is a complicated function. You would say that it can't reflect all the power forward unless it is a pure reactance. However, it can't be a pure reactance when it's got a 50-ohm transmitter that is an active source. So it's more complicated than just being a pure reactance. There is a resistive component. The resistive component, when the transmitter is active, does not become a energy absorber. So that in the big picture, all of the half power reflected from the antenna, hitting the antenna tuner, 100 watts worth, does get re-reflected forward and becomes, with the 41% increase in voltage, apparently what looks like with a directional coupler, a bird wattmeter, it looks like 200 watts forward. It really is 200 watts on the line. Only 100 watts of it is being radiated by the antenna. So as long as you know how to use the numbers, I say vector addition of voltages, current, energy, power. If you do it correctly, I think you can make it work. Back to you on that one, John. W2VDH, KQLIW.
Repeater, timeout.
In general, you cannot superpose power. In general, there are a couple of specific cases where you can. I can give a quick example. A 1 volt source at 0 degrees, in series with 50 ohms to a 50 ohm load, and then 1 volt at 90 degrees to a 50 ohm load. Now, when the two voltages are in quadrature like that, the power of each can be added. But if they're in phase with each other, two generators adding in phase, you can't superpose the power. In other words, the power of the two generators together is not equal to the sum of the individual powers. So in general, you cannot superpose power, but a few specific cases you can. That's like with a quadrature hybrid. Go ahead.
Are you sure you're talking about the power or you're talking about the voltage? I got lost. You have a voltage in phase, you're adding them, but not the power, until it's here.
Now, the quickest way to understand all this, from my point of view, John, and this is one of the things that's not made clear in all the courses that I've taken. Many times you see a guy writing all kinds of equations, and you're not sure is the equations he's writing. He says this is signal... He says this is signal number one, and this is... And he doesn't tell you whether or not that signal is voltage or power. Mother Nature almost always thinks in voltage. It's only mankind who thinks in power. Mother Nature almost always thinks in voltage. If, for instance, you have a transmitting antenna on mountain number one, and you've got a whole lot of multipath going on, some of the signal is going directly through the air to the antenna, the receiving antenna on mountain number two. Some of it's bouncing off the ground. Some of it's bouncing off of a water tower. Some of it's bouncing off of a building. Some of it's bouncing off a crazy reflection off the ionosphere or whatever. If you take the individual voltages from the individual signal paths in a vector manner, you're adding the voltages, including the phase angles, and you add all of those voltages at the receiving antenna, you come up with the right answer. Mother Nature thinks in voltages. So as long as you carry out all the individual steps correctly, adding voltages makes sense. In the case of those multipath signals, if I added the powers of the multipath signals, I would come up with an answer that's crazy. Except for the quadrature case, you're absolutely right. You cannot add powers. Mother Nature almost adds voltages in a vector manner. I wonder if you ever heard that one before, John. W2VDH, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. Yes, that's true. That that's the way Mother Nature works, and it's what causes the multipath dropouts and all that stuff. Yeah. It's an interesting discussion. One quick way of looking at it is just take a generator of 1 volt at 0 degrees, another generator of, let's say, 2 volts at 90 degrees, connect each one of them individually to a resistor and get the power, and then put them in series and get the power. And you see that when they are in quadrature, you can add the powers. But if they're in phase with each other, you cannot add the powers. You'll get a completely different answer if you try to take the sum of the powers of each one. Anyway, back to you, Dick.
Hey, you're absolutely right on that one, John. When I studied quadrature hybrids, I found that out, that crazy characteristic. Quadrature powers are the only place where they add. Regardless of who's the bigger and who's the smaller, they don't have to be equal to each other. The magic of a quadrature hybrid is that when you use it at the output of a transmitter, you're combining a pair of transmitters. And if you do it with a quadrature hybrid, with a termination on the fourth port, boy, do you get some magic out of that. No matter what the impedance of the individual signal generators was, they can be constant current generators, high, low, doesn't matter. When you look back into that source of signal through the quadrature hybrid, you will see exactly 50 ohms. And it's a great way to combine signals, and the two individual transmitters are thoroughly isolated from each other. They don't feed each other, they don't create spurious signals. So very few guys have got the nerve to dig deep enough into hybrid combining when they're combining two transmitters. But there's a lot to be said with doing it with a quadrature hybrid. And the quadrature hybrid, let me drop this. If you're combining a pair of 100-watt or 500-watt transmitters, you'd think you'd have to go out and buy a couple of 100-watt quadrature hybrid. And yes, as a off-the-shelf item, that's a little bit on the expensive side. As long as you understand how strip line works, you want to build it as a tri-plate strip line structure out of sheet metal. It's only $20 worth of raw materials, and to operate that at the kilowatt level is relatively easy to do. So for people who are combining transmitters, there's a lot to be said for that. And it gives you graceful degradation. If either transmitter dies, you're not off the air. You go down, in the worst case, you go down 60 dB in power output, but you're still on the air. And half the power, by the way, will be going into the termination. The difference in power goes into the termination when you're combining powers with that quadrature hybrid. Okay, Howie wanted to say something. W2HWW, K2LIW. Go ahead, Howie.
Okay, Dick. Just had to get my other radio. Two things. Number one, when you're trying to do modeling, you're probably going to have to replace the tube with a resistor at the input to the tank socket. That's the first thing. Number two, when you do superposition, You can't do, you can't add nonlinear power, nonlinear power sources. Go ahead. And then I got one more comment.
Now, when you're doing vector addition of RF circuits, for instance, or audio circuits, we're assuming you're starting off with a pure sine wave. And if it's not a pure sine wave and you're combining things, life can get very complicated. The new composite waveform is very different than either one of the individual waveforms in the general case. Power, yeah. Voltage addition definitely works. When you're figuring out what goes on with a PI network from a tetrode tube transmitter, yes, you can put the apparent load resistor substituted for the tube. That isn't necessarily the real impedance of the tube. That's the load resistor that gives you maximum power output of that tube with that particular plate supply. Assuming the tube, you know, can't go below 0 volts on the negative end of the sine wave and can't go much above twice the supply voltage on the positive end. So there's an apparent resistor that at the power output will give you that proper substitution for the input end of your PI network. However, if you did a small signal analysis of that tube and look back into it, that is not the resistance you would see at all. The load lines from the tube manufacturer are very different. You select a particular load line knowing what B plus voltage you're putting on the tube, and you're not going to get below 0 volts on the plate. That's not the real plate impedance. The real, when you look at the constant current load lines on the tube, they're almost pure horizontal lines, which means the impedance is an extremely high number. Over to you, Howie, K2RIW.
We agree. But, by the way, about getting off to another subject of tuning, say, a 6146, and looking at the screen, that only works in Class A. When you're in Class AB, I've seen tubes act differently. I've noticed that when I tuned up a transmitter, let's say running it at CW, then going to sideband, I found that you get a slightly different performance. I've noticed sometimes that you want to fiddle with the tank circuit when you're in sideband and you're actually doing a whistle or a hello. And I've noticed that. And I would say this, try to find out where you're at resonance. You know, dipping the plate, bringing a load up to whatever current you're supposed to. I think you're also, and I've noticed this, that you want to look at the RF output. If you have an SWR meter or you have an RF meter or something that's looking at the line, you want to try to get maximum output at resonance. And sometimes they're not always going to be exact. And that also could be a function that if the circuit is totally neutralized. But I've also found out, Dick, that believe it or not, when you're running either AM or CW, and then you go to sideband, or you got a sideband transmitter, you're going to find out that the tank circuit might act slightly different when you go from CW. Let's say you inject the carrier, you're running 70 or 80 watts, and you bring the transmitter all the way up to full power, then you go to sideband. I've noticed slight differences. Go ahead.
Yeah, maximum power output from a tube usually occurs in the Class C mode, key down, and a certain setting of your tank circuit. However, the actual waveform on that plate circuit is a very non-linear current voltage waveform. The current waveform on that plate of a Class C amplifier, maximum power output, is very non-linear. All kinds of harmonics are being generated. The beautiful tuning characteristics of the PI output network is a fantastic bandpass filter, letting through almost only the primary, and all those other harmonics are knocked down by 30, 40 dB until you add some extra filtering. When you want the amplifier to be a linear amplifier, you've got Class A or Class AB biasing. Now it's a very different load line on that tube, and the current now is going to be a very linear relationship of the signal going in. Under those conditions, you're going to see different screen current, different plate current, different loading, and so on. So Class C gives you maximum power output, but it's very nonlinear. You take a Class C amplifier and you start pouring sideband into it. The people you talk to are not going to give you very nice reports. Over to you, Howie, K2LIW.
Trans, I got a Clegg Venus or even a Drake 4 line. You put it into CW, you tune it up for maximum output, then you switch the transmitter into sideband. I've noticed that sometimes it's better to go into side, you know, after you tune it up the old-fashioned way in the CW mode, you ought to go into sideband and then whistle or say 555 or hello or whatever you want to do and play with the loading a little bit, play with the plate and loading a little bit and make some final adjustments. But you're absolutely right that when you're in single sideband, you're now operating, depending, like the Clegg Venus ran a 12-volt version of a 6146. It ran a 6883. I had a Clegg Venus. I also had the Apollo amplifier. That was a nice 700-watt amp. But running the 6883, which was a 6146, if you tuned it up where you unbalanced the modulator, because you had a balance control, believe it or not, that transmitter was built in the 60s, that transceiver, you had a balance control. So you would unbalance the transmitter, tune it up, say, not at full power, pretty close. Then you go to sideband and you'll find out you get slightly different. And you had to know how it behaved. You had to have an idea how it behaved. In those days, that thing ran about 800 volts at about 120 milliamp peaks. So when you're on sideband, you're at about 120 mils, and when you're idling with no signal, you are fully balanced out, you had about 40 mils on the plate. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when you start using an amplifier in the linear mode, in general, you're going to be adjusting for heavier plate loading. You don't want the plate circuit to come anywhere near the clipping potential on the high end or the low end, which would happen with light loading. So you have to sacrifice a little bit of the potential power output in order to get really linear relationships. And by way of the same kind of a scope display, you know, one of these butterfly diagrams or the triangular diagram, you can, with the scope set up correctly, with the audio is the horizontal deflection and the RF is the vertical deflection on the scope, you can now see your linearity, so to speak. That's one of many ways of displaying linearity, as well as a two-tone test. But you'll discover that the heavier plate loading with a slight sacrifice in power output gives you much more linear relationship. Class C gives you maximum power, but it's a very nonlinear waveform. There's a huge amount of harmonics going on in that plate circuit in the Class C mode. Any further comments on this one, Howie? WB2HWW, K2IW, the deck man.
Comments. When I was 14 years old or 15, whatever it was, I didn't have a scope. All I had was a watt meter, if I was lucky, and you would look at the play con meter and the RF meter to see if they were both tracking. If one was hanging a little bit, you knew you were out of residence or you had some issues. So it was a little gutsy back then. It was a little, what's called, caught flying by your seat of your pants stick.
And the magic of the two-tone test is that when you put two audio tones in there and you very carefully adjust the two tones to be absolutely equal in amplitude, because one's at a slightly higher frequency than the other, it's advancing faster in phase. So therefore, let me give an example. If I put in a tone of 1 kilohertz and 2 kilohertz, now you don't want them harmonic related, 1 kilohertz and 1.5 kilohertz, something like some number of milliseconds downrange, the two signals are in phase and you're getting twice the voltage. Another number of milliseconds downrange, the two audio signals are out of phase and you're getting zero voltage. Therefore, the two-tone test is cyclically going through absolute maximum power output of your transmitter and absolute minimum power output of the transmitter. And it's a very linear waveform in between as these two signals, audio signals, go in phase and out of phase. So you're sweeping the total dynamic range of the transmitter with a very characteristic waveform of those two audio signals added together in voltage. Therefore, there's a very exact envelope at each instant of time that's supposed to create. when the amplifier is thoroughly linear. Let me drop this.
Can you do the comment?
When that signal, when that beautiful waveform comes out of there, it's following this exact waveform of those two audio signals summed together, and nothing else comes out, and your spectrum analyzer will see in RF those two tones. Any nonlinearity, crossover distortion, flat topping, any nonlinearity along the slope is going to start creating third order intermodulation distortions instead of those two signals separated by half a KC on the screen. Of my example, you're going to see some other signals with that exact same spacing. It's going to create a Christmas tree. So it's a beautiful test where it is on each individual cycle of those two sine waves, you're sweeping the total dynamic range of the transmitter from zero power output to maximum power output. So it's a, as long as you've got a good spectrum analyzer, it's a very severe test. Or with a scope, that triangular pattern is not quite as good a test. A good spectrum analyzer, let me drop this. A good spectrum analyzer can see undesired component signals that are 50, 60, 70, 80 dB suppressed from the two main tones. Therefore, you can really see tremendous linearity. Whereas with that triangular test, the butterfly, the triangular test with an oscilloscope, you can barely see undesired components that are 15 to 20 dB down, because it's an extremely subtle change in the slope of that triangle, and that the eye is nowhere near as sensitive as a spectrum analyzer. Who is the other person who wanted to make a comment on this? Give me your full call letters and your name, and then proceed. K2RIW of the TechNet. My name is Dick. I thought there was another person that wanted to make a comment.
I know that, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't have a spectrum analyzer. I'm just telling you what we did back in the good old days. Did you ever operate 6 IBM 50? Because I know you're on the microwave guy. Did you ever get on 6 SSB?
I wish I did, but I never did. In the early days of 1960 or so, 62, 63, I was on narrowband FM sideband with a half kilowatt of power and had a lot of fun with that. But the sideband was getting very popular in those days, and I couldn't afford a sideband transmitter back then, and I wasn't enthusiastic enough to build one. We're way beyond the point where we should be going into the space report. So, Paul, WS2N, tell us what NASA has been doing this week and all these other guys. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet, you got it, Paul.
ZPZ with a comment about amplifiers and tuning transmitters.
Okay, this is WS2N. Yeah, Dick, leaving. I didn't have all that much space nets this week. There's going to be a lot of launches coming up. They had one last week, Intimat. You know, that one went up by Falcon 9 SpaceX successful, and now they plan on launching another one very shortly, within a couple of days. Total five that I could get up, you know, by the end of June. June 1st, the next one I'm really looking forward to is the launch of another Dragon spacecraft going to the International Space Station to resupply it. That's always very interesting. They bring up plenty of pressurized cargo and unpressurized cargo. You know, there's other companies that are involved on this commercial space race as well. Blue Origin, for instance, is building their new rocket, the New Glenn, and their own engines, building the BE-4. Liquid methane, liquid oxygen engine that will eventually be used in the New Glenn, seven of them on the first stage, one on the next stage, and there's a large engine, it's a large rocket, almost the size of a Saturn V rocket, and that will probably be our first take to the sky in 2020, originally planned for 2019, you know. I think stripped. SpaceX will have their competition. And if this guy had any plans of getting it up in 2019, he had something go seriously wrong on a test stand. He had his own test stand in Texas. And when I say he, Jeff Bezos, the owner of Blue Origin, so I think that might put them a little bit behind. Something but loose. They haven't really released the details on it yet. Let me drop it. But one topic I wanted to talk about, the Dragon is going up on June 1st. The last one that went up took a lot of supplies up. One of the things they took up was a small camera about the size of a shoebox, and they installed it through the Kaibo, that's the Japanese module that's up there, actually one of the larger modules, and they have an airlock system, and they took this camera and put it through the airlock, and they have a Japanese robotic arm, which took it and attached it to something called the porch or the patio. It's a large area, all kinds of experiments that take place out just outside the Kaibo module. One of these fields where you don't have to do a spacewalk, you use the robotic arm to put it in place. The camera that it had, it was called a CID instead of a CCD, what we're familiar with, you know, a charge couple device. It was a charge eject device. So I thought that was interesting, so I started looking into that. And apparently they're going to use this thing for astronomy. This charge injection device was developed in the early 70s, but really hasn't really taken off. They do use it for industrial purposes, but apparently it could really detect the difference in light from stars. For instance, a planet going around a star would have different light than the sun, than its sun, which is the star. And it might be able to the difference between that than the pixels themselves. Where the charge couple device apparently they have this different effect going from, you know, from one pixel to another, blurring it out. You really don't get a perfectly clean picture like you do with this CID camera. They take the amperage of each individual pixel and then amplify that and create a voltage out of it, and they use that, and they can get a perfectly clean picture, better than a CCD camera. I saw they had a picture of electronics on the screen. I was at on one website I was looking at. You could tell the difference. You know, with a close up view of a like surface mounted component. But CCD cameras, you can see it was all like blurred out. The light was shining, and you just saw it. You couldn't really see the fine little connections. But with the CID camera, you could. Something I never read about is something called the CID camera. And now they have it being tested on the space station. And apparently, the results are very good from what I read the test, and because of that, they plan on eventually using this for future telescope installations in space. So I'll just pass back to you, Dick, and I'll just stand by for now. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
For a while, the best in modern-day cameras, solid-state cameras, were charge-couple devices. And then there was some kind of a new camera devices that are being used today that are a lot quieter. Does somebody know the name of the new substitution for the focal plane array of a modern-day camera? What are those pixels made out of? They're not charge couple devices anymore. Does somebody know the name of the new ones? K2RIW. Hello? Would whatever they are, they are more field-effect light devices, as I remember. So these charge injection devices, from what you read on those, Paul, are they more sensitive? Do they have lower dark current, less noise, don't require cryogenic cooling? Do they have all those kind of benefits? When it comes to very low light level cameras for astrophotography, the background noise produced by the device, its ultimate sensitivity and its background noise is something very important, which usually forces people to cryogenically cool the device to try to lower the noise. And I bet you these CIDs require a lot less cryogenic cooling. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
I think it's CMOS.
Yeah, CMOS sounds like the right one. So CMOS pixels, I think, are the most sensitive ones and the quietest ones today. The person who just gave me the CMOS answer, is that believed to be the quietest pixels and the most sensitive ones? Go ahead.
I think it's quieter, but not necessarily more sensitive, but I'm not sure.
Who am I talking to? I recognize that voice.
K1MJN, Mike number 2.
I thought so. Thank you, Mike. And so, CMOS is quieter, and we don't know if they're more sensitive. And my guess is there are people that are cryogenically cooling CMOS. Is that true, Mike?
People are cooling them, but I don't know about cryogenic. I don't think they're taking it quite that far from what I've seen.
Yeah, there are some devices, as you get colder and colder, they get quieter, but maybe they stop working. I know that there were certain transistors, and I think they were field effect transistors. Yes, they were field effect transistors that Airborne Instruments Laboratory's Central Research Department was cryogenically cooling them, I think with liquid nitrogen and eventually with liquid helium, where you get down to 4 degrees Kelvin, really, really cold. And some of these transistors would turn off. They would stop conducting current at all when you went below a certain temperature. And the discovery they made is that the transistor didn't like to be in the dark. They put a small light-emitting diode alongside of the transistor when it's being cryogenically cooled, and they got the best of both worlds. It kept operating, and it got very quiet and kept its sensitivity when it was cryogenically cooled with a light-emitting diode alongside of it. Ain't that crazy? Over to you, Mike, K2LIW.
Roger that, yeah. I think for the most part, I think most people are still using the CCDs for the lowest light, but I think the CMOS are less noisy. Back over to you, Dick.
From what you know, Mike, if I buy a state-of-the-art camera today, like the latest one that can be bought, a 35mm format, it looks like, but it's really a solid-state camera, and they go up to numbers like 200,000 apparent ASA, I'll bet you those are CMOS pixels. What do you think, Mike, K2LIW?
Roger that. Yeah, the regular cameras, everyday 35mm DSLRs, I believe most of them are CMOS. I think there are a couple CCDs. I think Canon came out with a sensor about a year ago. I forgot how many megapixels it is. It's a very large number of megapixels. I think that's still CCD, though.
But think about it, Mike. When you've got a camera with an apparent ASA of 200,000, I think you can take a picture with the lens cap on. I know that some of my buddies own some of these cameras. They also own some very nice Cassegrain telescopes, and they're talking about putting the two together, putting the digital SLR camera with a super ASA on an oscilloscope. There is an article that was just published in, I think, Sky and Telescope in the last week or two. KG2T, Joe, brought this to my attention, where because the camera has such a high ASA, and therefore you can take such a brief picture, you no longer need tracking on the oscilloscope. You can take a deep sky picture nowadays, and because you're taking it at a 60th of a second or something like that, as opposed to 60 seconds, you no longer need a tracking motor, and you run the camera in the... Let me drop this. You run the camera in the motion picture mode, we're taking X number of frames per second. And you take 100 of those frames, and with the right computer program, you lay all of those frames on top of each other, the computer program will register them for you. When you take 100 consecutive frames, because the sky is always sweeping, the last frame is going to be a little bit aimed in a different angle than the first frame. But the modern-day computer programs will do that aligning for you, and when you stack them on top of each other, you get a hell of a lot of noise cancellation and a hell of a lot of the very deep skies objects, very deep, very dim stars suddenly start coming out. So there's this beautiful article that was shipped to me describing how to do this. It was published in the last couple of weeks, and I wonder if you've heard about that article, Mike. K1MJM, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Dick, I didn't hear about the article, but I did look up the Canon camera, and it is, you're right, it is a CMOS camera, and it's 204,000 ISO, and as far as the stacking, we do over at the Westport Astronomical Society, we actually photograph occultations, and we use cameras that have built-in, super low-light cameras that have built-in stacking. And we can stack probably up to 256, but we usually only do a couple at a time so that we could get the timing perfect or as good as can be. Back over to you.
So you're saying that the computer program will tolerate a stacking as high as 250. When you do that, you get a huge amount of noise cancellation. Another thing that they told me in the article, which I don't quite understand, is that you take a couple of background pictures of dark sky, as long as and you combine that with the let's say 100 frames that you intend to stack. I'm not quite sure what the other background frames are doing for you. Maybe that's telling you, oh yes, some of your pixels are in the dark more sensitive than others. Some of them have a different amount of dark background current. So when you take a picture with the lens cap on, so to speak, you're finding out which of your pixels are biased a little bit to positive or negative, and you can crank that back out when doing the stacking process. Therefore, you get a more accurate astrophotography. Is that approximately what's going on here? K1MJM, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Roger, Dick, that's what it is. They call them dark frames. You take the dark frames and you combine them in the software with the rest of your photos, and it gets rid of noise, certain types of noise, and hot pixels. K1MJM, back over to you.
So when you combine all of this with something like an 8-inch Cassegrain telescope, my guess is you can probably take pictures of things down to magnitude 14 or something like that. What do you think? K2LIW.
Roger, Dick, when we do our occultation photography, we commonly get down to, I want to say 12 and a half in that ballpark, but I believe we can go lower. We're using an 11 and a half inch telescope, I'm sorry, 12 and a half inch reflector, and we're soon to install a 16.
Now, in occultation photography, I think you're taking a planet or an asteroid or something that's, because of your desirable location at this instant of time, it's waving in front of a particular star. And as it waves in front of that star, looking at the light curve of luminance versus time can give you information about is there an atmosphere on that object that's doing the occulting. Is that approximately what's going on? And you're trying to find that light curve of amplitude of brilliance versus time in order to figure out whether or not the object has an atmosphere. K1MJM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I haven't seen anybody talking about atmospheres on these asteroids. They do want to know the size and the shape and velocity and the exact location. So simultaneously, a bunch of people all over the country are photographing them. And then there's an organization that puts all the timing frames together, and you use GPS timestamp on each frame at 30 frames a second or faster. So when they combine them, they know the velocity, the shape, the size, the spin. They can actually calculate the spin. They put all that together. Actually, one of them, they actually found a ring around it.
I haven't seen too much with atmosphere, but I imagine they could. Back over to you.